It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a reporter goes to the source of recent immigration to the United States and tells us why Central American youth are being driven to make the journey north.
First, the Oak Hill Prison Humanities Project has been working with inmates at one of Wisconsin's minimum security prisons to open up worlds of poetry and literature to the people incarcerated there. Now, a new initiative is bringing the art of Oak Hill inmates to Wisconsin with a new exhibit called Artists in Absentia.
The exhibit will feature writing, art, music, and dramatic work of inmates to the Madison Public Library's Central Branch, with plans to move the exhibit to other libraries in southern Wisconsin. The opening reception is Thursday, March 3rd at 6 o'clock.
Jose Vergara joins us now to talk about the new exhibition. He's a graduate student at UW-Madison, a longtime volunteer with the Oak Hill Prison Humanities Project, and the organizer of the new exhibit, Artists in Absentia. Jose, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with the Oak Hill Prison Humanities Project. How did that get started?
Sure. Well, a number of people and groups have been volunteering and teaching classes at Oak Hill since 2007 or so. And in 2013, we received these nice, large, generous grants that allowed us to bring together all our forces, all our funds. So the Oak Hill Prison Humanities Project was officially founded in 2013. And since then, we've expanded and been able to offer new classes on new topics.
So basically, the Humanities Project teaches classes there. What kinds of offerings are there?
Right now, we're offering philosophy, creative writing, drama, fiction, and different times art. We're hoping to bring this art class that's part of the exhibition coming up. It really depends on the volunteers involved, but also the interests of the inmates there. We try to offer classes that'll bring in new participants.
And what kind of response have you gotten over the years?
It's been very positive, both from the administration and the participants, the inmate artists and writers, anyone who comes to the classes. They're there by choice. They don't receive any credit. They're free classes. They don't pay for them. They simply want to learn about new topics, learn about the world, expose themselves to new ideas. And in the classes where we have kind of practical component, whether it's creative writing or the art classes where they make paintings, they can also hone their skills and ideally get to use those after release as well.
So tell us a little bit about how the new Artists in Absentia project that's about to open, how did that come about?
I came up with the idea about a year ago. It's been about a year in the works, and it's hard to believe that it's finally happening. I keep thinking that there's more that we have to do. But I, as you mentioned, had been volunteering at Oak Hill for a number of years now, and in the classes that I led, which were creative writing and literature classes, I saw that these guys were coming up with really great material and really great stories that I wish more people could hear. I can definitely paraphrase them and tell people about them.
Yeah, you want to tell us about one or two of the most striking ones or some that you remember?
Sure. The one that always comes to mind is this three-sentence prose poem. Really stark and very minimal, about a lightning bug that was captured in a bell jar, and each time it blinks its light is a second closer to death. But I can tell you about it, but it's not the same thing as seeing it, and it doesn't do justice to the work being created there. And I wanted to organize this exhibition as a means to get these men's voices out there and allow their work to be seen and heard.
So I get the sense it's important to you, but also important to them. What have they told you about what it means to them to create, but then to have their creative works go on to have new life outside of Oak Hill?
Mm-hmm. I think that's central to why they participated, that they wanted to be seen as creative individuals who had these voices and ideas that they want to share with the local community, but as broad as we can get it, that they don't want to be seen as simply inmates with or a number, but that they're making art that deserves to be seen. They want to share and contribute to the culture around us.
And I understand you worked alongside a documentary filmmaker on this project. What was that experience like?
That director is Mark Kornblad, local filmmaker. He actually filmed a documentary full length, about an hour long, about the Oak Hill Prison Humanities Project a couple of years ago. So when I was developing this exhibition, I came to him and we worked out a plan for how he might be involved, and kind of snowballed. He went in and he saw the work being made, the passion of all the people involved, and ultimately came up with a web series to preview the exhibition. You can check that out on our website. And now he's premiering a early version of a shorter documentary strictly about the creation of the exhibition. And it's been really wonderful. We, in particular, were amazed at the access that we've been able to receive from the administration at the prison. They're very accommodating and supportive of this kind of work. So that's a delight.
So it sounds as though there were so many people who wanted to lend their voices, their talents, mm-hmm. especially for the documentary film, that it just got bigger than the director there had foreseen. Why do you think participation was so robust like that?
I think having a range of components involved, we have drama, art, writing, music, there's just this range of voices and different ways people can contribute, and certainly some overlap, some people that made paintings also played music. But my sense is that the participants saw this, again, as an opportunity to get involved in something special and something that they don't get to do every day.
We're talking right now with Jose Vergara, graduate student at UW-Madison, and a longtime volunteer with the Oak Hill Prison Humanities Project, the organizer also of the new exhibition called Artists in Absentia. It takes work from the inmates at that Oak Hill prison, and there's drama, there's music, there's a lot here, painting. Mm-hmm. And do you have a sense about how creating art from inside the prison influenced the art? If you were to go to this and not really mm-hmm. know anything about the background, would you realize that there was a theme coming out here, or is it just really varied?
Definitely both of those. There's some pieces that are, there's a painting of, the artist called it Country Painting. It's just a scene of somewhere in the woods in a cabin, some deer. So really just a memory from his head that he compiled from different experiences in his life. But then certainly other pieces, some of the writing, some of the drama, even the music. Some of these pieces are definitely about their experiences in the prison system, and those are more obvious, and you see these themes. But also in the pieces that aren't about incarceration, certainly there's some themes and commonalities among them that I think the audience will pick up on.
And I imagine if you're an artist, one of the cool things is getting to know, for a lot of artists anyway, how people respond, how it's going mm-hmm. over. So how will the inmates at Oak Hill get that same feedback about their mm-hmm. art?
We're trying to do a number of things. First of all, tomorrow, March 2nd, we hope, it seems to be happening, we'll be going in to Oak Hill and showing them the Marx documentary, and a special preview screening. They'll be the first group to see it. So they'll have that. We've built this website, artistinabsentia.com, where anyone can come and see all the pieces. The full site will launch on the 3rd at the same time as the exhibition opening. So friends and family of the inmates can check that out, maybe share it with them in some form. And we're also hopeful, optimistic that at some point down the line we can also come in with photos or some kind of feedback to the artists themselves and show them what we've done with their work. A big part of the program at the Bubbler is kind of forming a feedback loop. So if you come to the Bubbler throughout the month of March, you can respond to the work, and we'd also like to get that back to the inmates in some form.
And do you have any plans to take this idea and bring it to other prisons in the state?
I'm not sure. I mean, of course, working with this population, this kind of system, it's tough. As I mentioned, this particular administration has been so supportive of what we've done. So I think we have a good model for classes as well as these kinds of art exhibitions programs. So we're definitely open to collaborations. I know there, in Racine, for example, there's a Shakespeare prison project that's really wonderful, and these kinds of programs are popping up more and more. So we're open to it.
Jose, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Jose Vergara is a graduate student at UW-Madison, a longtime volunteer with the Oak Hill Prison Humanities Project, and the organizer of the new exhibition. We're talking about Artists in Absentia, and you can see that exhibition throughout the month of March at the Madison Public Library Central Branch, maybe moving outward from there as well. The opening reception is Thursday, March 3rd at 6.
Coming up, our guest went to Central America to find out what's driving young people to seek refuge in the United States and to see how American-funded programs are trying to improve conditions there. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, voters in a dozen states head to the polls today to vote in the presidential primaries. We'll get a Super Tuesday preview.
First, in recent years, Central America has become a main source of immigration to the United States, with large numbers of young people arriving at the border, driving a strong political debate here in the U.S. Almost 100,000 unaccompanied minors have crossed the border into the southwestern U.S. since 2014. More are expected in the coming months.
Our next guest went to the source and visited El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, his goal to look at the dangerous high crime conditions that were leading young people to make the journey across Mexico to the United States and see what American-funded programs are doing to try to improve conditions there.
Alan Gomez joins us now. He's a reporter who covers immigration at USA Today. Alan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we might hear, Alan, these three countries have high crime rates, and people might think, well, we've got a lot of crime in the United States, too. Can you tell us, though, about the scale of crime in these three countries?
Yeah, it's always one of those things that's really hard to articulate to folks here in the United States. But just to give a little bit of a sense, El Salvador last year had 104 homicides per 100,000 people. Honduras was in the 70s, Guatemala was in the 50s. In the United States, that's four. We're talking just by an order of magnitude, so much more violent, so much more threatening than anything we experience here. And being able to spend a few days down there, you start to really realize that, you know, it's not like cities here in the U.S. where you have your good areas, your bad areas, you kind of know where you can go. No, it's just everywhere down there, because the threat of not just homicides, but kidnappings, extortions, just regular criminality is just so stunning. It's just everywhere people go down there.
And you talk to young people in Honduras and other countries, for that matter. How did they talk about crime? How did it affect their lives?
I mean, it's from start to finish, basically. I mean, I'll tell you about this one young lady I spoke to in El Salvador. She is finishing her college degree. She's taken a class funded by Microsoft and by USAID, that's the U.S. Agency for International Development, to get some computer skills. And, you know, you talk to her and she just seems like a very intelligent, put-together young lady. She hasn't bought a laptop because she just assumes that it's going to get stolen at some point. She wants to find a job after she graduates, but the job situation down there is so difficult, even for people with those kind of skills, that companies actually have wait lists for jobs that are already filled. And on top of that, she was telling me that her curfew is 9 o'clock. She's usually home by 8. And I don't know how many American kids you've ever heard even say something like that, but she said basically anytime she's out, she just always gets that sense that something's about to go down, something's about to get ugly down there. And so she just makes it home before the sun really sets. And so that just, it's a small little example, but I cannot tell you how often I came across that. Kids telling me just like very casually, just about how many friends they've lost along the years, throughout the years, due to gang violence, relatives who've gotten killed. And it's just unbelievable. Just everywhere you turn, everybody has a story about having lost somebody, not just the threat or things like that, but having lost somebody to this incredible gang violence that's going out within those three countries.
You mentioned these high murder rates, the high crime rates. El Salvador, I think it was the leading murder rate in the world. The only places with more violent deaths are places that are actually war zones, places like Syria. Why? Do we have an understanding of why crime and murder are so endemic in Central America these years?
Well, it's several things. I mean, first off, obviously, these are the places where the drugs that are coming to the United States are being trafficked through. You know, places further south in Central America, they actually get bypassed to some degree because cartels that, you know, where the drugs originate mostly in South America, they're usually flown to places like Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador to continue the trek up north. So you have this sort of this fight to control those avenues of where all those drugs are going to go through. But another thing that's really contributed to it is that these gangs, like there's a gang called MS-13 that is incredibly widespread in the United States. It has ties to El Salvador. That's where its members originated. But, you know, to hear people down there talk about it, before those gangs were, you know, regular kind of just, you know, punching, beat people up kind of gangs. And sorry if that's not the technical term for it. But they've really developed as the U.S. has deported in huge numbers members with violent gang ties here in the United States. So as they would return to their home countries and sort of integrate themselves with those gangs and then team up with these drug cartels that are pushing the drugs further north, that's combined to create this incredibly violent organizations that you have in each of these countries. So where before they were just arguing over, you know, dumb turf battles or stuff like that, now they're responsible and trying to control incredibly lucrative drug trafficking channels. And so that's all kind of piled up. You add the fact that these governments don't really have a lot of institutional strength. That's a lot of what the United States is trying to help them with. So the governments are very weak, are very corrupt, a lot of corruption within the judicial system. So there's not a lot of retribution for people. There's not a lot of justice for people who are committing a lot of this violence. So you just kind of put that all together, and it sort of creates this lawless scenario in so many parts of this country, of these countries.
Talking to Alan Gomez from the USA Today about his recent trip to Central America, reporting on the sources of youth immigration, would-be refugees to the United States. And Alan, talking to young people there, they're weighing a big question. I guess the risk of trying to cross Mexico, trying to cross the border in the United States, the hope of not being sent right back versus the risk of staying put and all the crime that you're talking about. How do they talk about that decision?
Yeah, and that's one of the things. I mean, they all face that. I mean, even parents, I've talked to some parents of kids who are as young as like 5 or 6, already having that talk with their kids about, you know, that decision that they're going to have to make at some point. So on the one hand, you know, I spoke to many young kids who are very eager to try to stay in their countries. They like their countries. They want to stay there. They want to make it work. But when you combine their horrible economies, combined with the raging violence they see all around them, obviously tens of thousands of them have decided to make that journey. But at the same time, they all hear the stories about what happens on the way. They have to cross at least through all of Mexico, and that is just an incredibly horrible story. I mean, I've heard some, just talking to so many of them, telling me stories about what happened to their friends, to their relatives, to themselves through Mexico, where, let's just say, the Mexican police is not really helping these folks as they're passing through these areas. They're sort of faced with, do I go on this incredibly perilous journey? If I'm a woman, I'm probably going to get sexually assaulted along the way. If I'm a man, you know, I'm lucky to make it alive. Or do I stay here in this country where I could very, very well face the same fate? So they're stuck between a horrible rock and a hard place. That's why you're seeing so many of them in these last few years really saying, okay, it's worth the risk. Let me go ahead and take the risk to try to cross Mexico and get to the United States.
Alan, you mentioned briefly U.S. aid earlier. What is the United States doing in these three countries, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, to try to change conditions, change that balance to where it's more amenable to stay put for these young people?
Well, we've been helping down there for many, many years. But what's happening now is really interesting. So just this past December, Congress approved $750 million to go to those three countries. That's tripling the usual amount of aid that we send to those three countries. And what they're trying to do is sort of figure out a new way of directing that money. Before, it was mostly just security, security, security. So we're talking about assisting law enforcement, adding more training for their officers, helping the judicial system get better, helping judges, helping provide security for witnesses, you know, kind of on the law enforcement and justice side of things. But what I was hearing a lot down there, and I was talking to, and speaking with the U.S. ambassador to Honduras and speaking to some government officials in each of these countries, what they're trying to do is switch things more into sort of the USAID realm of things. And by that, I mean trying to do more programs to help these young kids get the education, sort of the gang diversion programs, and try to create more of an economic system where they can thrive in, so that they can sort of create a level of economic independence where they can sort of create literally a zone to protect themselves. So many communities there, if you have enough money, I mean, are completely walled off. I mean, we have a sense of sort of gated communities here in the U.S., but I can tell you down there, it's a lot different. There's an armed guard with an assault rifle at the front. The bars are higher. The walls are higher. And so if they can just get into these kind of communities, if they can create the sort of economic independence to sort of insulate themselves from this violence to some degree, that's what they think is going to help them stay there more. So we're sort of seeing this shift from a security-focused aid program to more of a trying to empower them and try to improve their economic situation so that they can create a better situation for themselves down there.
The United States has militarily intervened in this region over the decades. Is there trust for the United States? Are people saying, oh, good, the United States is here to help in this new, different way? Or are people kind of steering clear of it?
They're taking the help. I mean, it's one thing to look back at history and sort of resent American involvement in Latin America. And I can tell you that there are plenty of countries throughout the region that still hold that. But these places are so desperate that they just have no other recourse. I mean, there are other agencies that have and other international organizations that have stepped in to help. In Guatemala, for example, the United Nations created a system about 10 years ago to help them with their judicial system. And that has yielded incredible results. Last year, it led to the arrest of the country's president, its vice president, several cabinet ministers, many business leaders. And so that sort of model is something that can help. So trust me, they take help wherever they can get it. And now with all this extra money coming from the United States, they're just hoping it can lead to that same result. I mean, yeah, people down there, obviously, they have their reservations with the United States, with our history down there, with the fact that a lot of the violence that they're seeing is a result of the drugs that Americans are using. And so, yeah, there's plenty of resentment there. But at the same time, they realize that at this point, they're pretty much powerless to stop it.
Alan, we'll leave it there. That's Alan Gomez from USA Today. His reporting is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up, we'll talk Super Tuesday. This is Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, Governor Walker has signed over 40 bills into law this week. We'll take a look at the legislation in about half an hour.
First, Super Tuesday is upon us. Voters in 12 states, asterisk sort of a 13th, Wyoming is weird, also one territory, are heading to the polls today to cast their ballots for the candidate they'd like to see in the White House.
Joining us now to talk about Super Tuesday and what we can expect to see from today's primaries and caucuses is Karen Hoffman. She's a visiting assistant professor of political science at Marquette University. Karen, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. It's an exciting time in politics.
Right, today is pretty exciting, and there's so many states at play today, which is, I guess, kind of unusual because you've been watching one state trickle in after another, Iowa, New Hampshire. Now, boom, 12 at once. Why?
Well, there's all this jockeying for position about who gets to be first in the primaries, and for a while, states kept wanting to move up, you know, sooner in the process so they could have a bigger role. But the parties at some point said, you know, no one except for the very beginning states could stay there, and everyone else had to go later on. So, you know, there's the rule, but everyone still wants to be as soon as they can according to the rules. So hence, March is a very big month. And, yeah, I mean, it's we've been, dissecting each individual primary, and now we're going to have to do a lot at one time. So,
yeah, people who research this, you've got to be ready for data overload come from tomorrow.
Oh, my gosh.
Morning, right?
That is for sure.
So what's at stake here? I mean, is this something that generally is expected to be a huge decider, maybe even the decider? Is there often just one candidate left when the dust settles after Super Tuesday?
I have to preface my remarks by saying that this cycle has been anything but typical. So what is typical for a cycle might not be true for this one. However, I do think that there's some people, some candidates who have more at stake tomorrow perhaps than other ones. Ted Cruz, originally, I remember months ago when people were talking about how well-positioned he was for Super Tuesday. He's got a great organization in a lot of these states. And yet now Trump has really, you know, stolen some of his thunder. And, you know, he really needs to do awfully well in Texas and even, you know, do fairly well elsewhere. Otherwise, it's hard to see how he can keep competing with Trump going forward.
And what about Bernie Sanders?
Well, you know, he has vowed to stay in this to the convention, so I guess in that sense, it doesn't really matter. However, there's this whole psychological aspect to these primaries, which is the momentum. And while it doesn't actually seem fair to all of us states who have to vote later on, momentum seems to take on a life of its own. And I guess some are concerned for Bernie that if Hillary can really get ahead of steam and start winning a lot of states tomorrow, that the momentum is going to help her even further. And, at some point, people start jumping on a bandwagon. So I guess that's a fear for Bernie. And plus, a lot of these states look better for Hillary Clinton in terms of winning them in the South. So, but I think he's going to stay in. So it's not a question of whether he's going to drop out or not.
One thing that limits the impact of Super Tuesday is that as we go through the primaries, some states are winner take all. You win a state like Ohio, I think. John Kasich's hoping to win that because you get all the delegates then.
Right.
Most of these today are proportional representation of some sort. So even if I win this state, the second place finisher might get just a few fewer delegates. So this, even winning in all or most states, might not be a slam dunk win for whoever wins it.
That's absolutely correct. I think after the 15th of March, there are more Republican primaries that are winner take all. The Democratic primaries, pretty much none are winner take all. Although the rules for delegating, or for assigning delegates are incredibly complicated in each state. The thing is, especially in the Republican race where you still have more than two candidates, the challenge is that because each delegate or each candidate is getting delegates, it makes it really hard for any one candidate to get to the halfway mark. And so that can be really frustrating for people. Like even for Donald Trump, as for a front runner, as you point out, he cannot at this point yet just kind of sweep delegates. And he's going to have to keep plugging away because everyone else is still getting them as well. This thing is going to go on for a while yet.
So looking at the GOP field again for a moment, how important is the number two slot tomorrow if Donald Trump, as he's looking likely to at this point, does pretty well, kind of sweeps the first runner spot? Does a number two person then either become sort of the person that the establishment Republican pins their hopes on, and can they that person then make the case that who's ever number three can maybe should drop out so that there can be more consolidation?
Well, that makes perfect sense. Everything you said makes perfect sense, again, except for in this cycle. I did read that Rubio's campaign is trying to downplay expectations a little bit for tomorrow, because that's the thing about number two and number three. It seems so silly, it doesn't necessarily matter where you end up as long as you exceed expectations. So, although clearly winning is best. But there's going to be a lot of jockeying and trying to spin narratives about, where people should end up. And then if a candidate can claim they did a lot better than they were supposed to, then they can say, well, see, I should still be in the race. And as you say, I mean, the Republicans, some are really looking for sort of an establishment-type candidate that they can all rally around. It just seems as though every time we have a primary and we think that exactly what you said is going to happen, it doesn't. There are some people that dropped out, but we're still not quite winnowed down yet. And so I guess I hesitate to predict that that would happen. I mean, if you can spin a second or third place win as sort of a victory, then you're going to move on.
We're talking to Karen Hoffman, visiting assistant professor of political science at Marquette University, talking about today's Super Tuesday primaries. 12 states going to the polls today. Wyoming's been in the field on the caucuses for a couple weeks, as I understand it. One territory in there as well. Wisconsin, not one of those states, however, Karen. And is there a sense of injustice for later states who often have exactly one candidate to choose from in each party? And is there still an effort sometimes to nudge forward, maybe try to jump on the Super Tuesday bandwagon?
Well, I mean, I think the parties really try to kind of put the kibosh on more and more people moving up. And yes, to some extent, there is a sense of injustice. And not necessarily just in the order that you are voting, but, some people point to the very early states as being completely unrepresentative of the American electorate. So that, they say, oh, well, there would be other states that you would actually learn something about what the American public thinks instead of, states like Iowa and New Hampshire. However, you know, the status quo is pretty tough to change sometimes because everyone, you know, has something, or a lot of people have something to gain from it. So, you know, I don't anticipate huge changes in this system, even though you are correct. There are some that feel like, okay, it's all over now. Why should I vote?
By one measure that I saw, 20%, only 20% of American adults vote in primaries. Mm-hmm. How does that compare with how many will vote in the general election?
Oh, it will change dramatically. But I think it's important to note it's not just going to change in terms of the number of people who vote, although absolutely more people will vote. It also has to do with sort of the political beliefs of primary voters versus general election voters. And primary voters tend to be, sort of for the Democrats and Republicans, the very consistently sort of conservative Republicans and the very consistently liberal Democrats. So primary voters don't look exactly like general election voters. A general election is really a new ballgame.
And for candidates and their strategy, early on, obviously, they can focus on Iowa or New Hampshire, or maybe hold off till South Carolina. How does it change the game when you've got 12 states at play at once, and then some states like Wisconsin that might be crucially important to you or might be a foregone conclusion?
It gets hard. And here's where the candidates who have really been working for months at building local, you know, grassroots organizations, sort of the ground game. This is where those candidates end up sort of getting a benefit from all of that hard work, because you can't, as you point, a candidate can only be in so many places. So, you know, some of these candidates have really spent a lot of time getting field offices opened, you know, getting volunteers on the ground in all of these states. And that really helps when you have so many races happening in one day, because then you have a lot of surrogates going out for you, knocking on doors, making phone calls, and that stuff matters. So
we're talking Super Tuesday right now with Karen Hoffman, assistant professor of political science at Marquette University. And we want to hear from you. What do you think the outcome is going to be today? Which candidate would you like to see come away from Super Tuesday with the most delegates? We're taking your comments on the Central Time Facebook page.
And you can call in now at 800-642-1234. Who are you pulling for our neighbors in Minnesota? What's been the scene at the polls? And for Wisconsinites, how do you feel about being a voter in a state that doesn't go to the polls until well after Super Tuesday? Does it make you feel like your vote doesn't count quite as much? Call in at 800-642-1234. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're continuing our conversation about Super Tuesday, and you can join in. Who do you want to see win today, and who would you maybe like to see drop out tomorrow? You going to be up watching these results, or are you going to wait and see what happens tomorrow morning? Well, you can call us at 800-642-1234, or you can give us your take on the Central Time Facebook page.
Karen Hoffman stays with us. She's visiting assistant professor of political science at Marquette University. Karen, I want to talk about home field advantage. We've got Ted Cruz in Texas today, Bernie Sanders in Vermont, Hillary Clinton, it's been a while, but Arkansas, and then coming up later in the month, Kasich in Ohio, Rubio in Florida. Does that that home field advantage actually translate into a benefit? Will it this year because of Donald Trump on the Republican side?
Oh, gosh. Well, I guess you pointed out the one flaw in using the typical scenario. Clearly, it does to some extent. You know, Cruz in Texas, I mean, he's favored to win Texas, and that has no doubt something to do, you know, the fact that he is from Texas. So, you know, home field advantage does matter. Whether or not, you know, that extends any farther, though, is, you know, not terribly clear. Bernie Sanders will probably do well. I'm not sure. We'll have to see. I'm not sure if Hillary Clinton would do well in Arkansas because of the roots there or just because the demographics in that state tend to favor her more somewhat. So, but, I mean, once those states are done, then, I mean, it's back to the, you know, the fighting again. So it's only worth so much and not much more.
So looking again at the Republican side of things, if Marco Rubio doesn't prevail in at least one state, maybe not his own, but maybe his own, what happens tomorrow?
That's a good question. It's possible that he might not win a state. And I think, as I mentioned earlier, it sounds as though his campaign team is already trying to get a narrative going that he wasn't expected to really win any of these states. So the fact that if he did come in, you know, a strong second or possibly even third, that shows his that he is getting stronger and, you know, in terms of moving forward. I'm not sure. I mean, he would have won no states if that had happened, you know, up to this point. And it seems like that would be sort of a hard narrative to sell. But I'm pretty sure they're going to try if that's what happens. Well, and then the other thing is, because so many people really would like to have another alternative besides Trump and or Cruz, you know, maybe that would help him in doing that.
We'll go to a caller now. We've got Brad on the line in Wausau. Brad, hi.
Hello.
What do you think?
I'm sorry?
What did you want to say on the air, Brad?
Well, the question I have is, we keep talking about, and not so much on this program, but other programs, the negativity of Trump and Cruz and Rubio and so forth, as well as Hillary and Sanders. What I'm really not understanding is why the media is not spending more time accentuating the positives and what these candidates are standing for and fact-checking versus publicizing the name-calling and so forth and so on that goes on. As an example, you have Kasich, who has a tremendous track record. He's done a lot of things, been very, very successful, but he's rarely ever mentioned in terms of plus or minus, in terms of the qualities that he brings to the party.
Brad, thanks a lot for the call. So, Karen, he's saying the media is rewarding bad behavior, in effect, jumping on and reinforcing. We're giving attention to the negative stuff, so we keep getting the negative stuff.
Well, I think partly, although there's not really time here, I think you do have to distinguish between different types of media sources. So perhaps all of them don't do this in the same way. The other interesting thing about negativity, although I would agree with you that we're really kind of dragging awfully, you know, getting awfully low into the gutter these days, is, you know, there are actually scholars who have done research on negativity. And, well, first of all, apparently it is effective. So we can't really expect, you know, campaigns to not do that, even if we would like them not to. And also that people learn things about candidates when there's negativity. Now, again, I do agree, and I can understand. Well, I'm myself frustrated sometimes at listening when all we hear about is, you know, personal comments about appearance, which seems to have really nothing to do with the debate. But unfortunately, we do have this fascination with this stuff. And I guess I would say that sometimes I try to search out some of the non-mainstream media sources to kind of dig into that stuff more deeply. But, I mean, there are a lot of people who like to hear that stuff. And so I think we're going to continue to have it covered. That's unfortunately the answer.
And does that kind of mean that Donald Trump has the advantage here? Because the cameras love him. He's very quotable. And so the majority of coverage has been about Donald Trump for those reasons, in part at least. Are people, the voters, getting their information because that one candidate is so charismatic for the camera?
That's true. It's a real kind of it's a double-edged sword, because to some extent you don't want to reward that kind of behavior. But on the other hand, you know, some of the media sources who have tried to criticize him for this, it almost backfires on them, because his supporters are then very indignant and think that, you know, the media is out to get him. So to some extent, it doesn't even work when they try to, you know, call him out on this. And I think it's just a tough position to be in. But yes, it absolutely favors, I mean, some of the debates, it seems as though everything kind of circulated around Donald Trump, whether or not you were picking on him or he was defending himself. It's hard to know exactly how to deal with that, but people want to hear it, so apparently we're going to continue.
Talking to Karen Hoffman at Marquette University about Super Tuesday and presidential politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. So, Karen, you've mentioned a couple times this is an unusual one. There's a small sample size of presidential races to choose from to begin
with. Right, this is true.
And this one seems weird. I've seen some people say on the Republican side, this isn't just weird. It's maybe some kind of realignment. Donald Trump is reaching Republican voters in a way other Republicans aren't. There may be some kind of split. There may be a change in the demographics of who supports who. Do you think this is that big a deal?
I have thought for the last few cycles that there is this internal struggle going on in the Republican Party. And, you know, you can see that there were many people unhappy when John McCain was running, you know, that he wasn't sufficiently conservative. There were the same people, many of them were very upset when Mitt Romney was the next nominee. And I suspected for some time that at some point going to come to a head because some of these groups don't fit together well. And, you know, this could be the election that, you know, there's some kind of splintering or there's some kind of realignment or something that, you know, the Republican Party has these disparate elements that really don't get along right now. And at some point to have, you know, a unified party, they need to. I'm not exactly sure what's going to happen. Is somebody going to leave? You know, are some of the groups going to, you know, change their views a little bit? But yeah, I think that this is pretty significant.
So do you see that all playing out in the next several months? We already have the Tea Party, which is one sliver that we're talking about. You have more establishment Republicans, and then I'm not sure exactly how you would categorize what Donald Trump represents, maybe dissatisfaction with the government. So what do you think about how this could play out in the different scenarios?
It's a good question, because the thing is, I don't think that Trump maps really well onto one particular group of Republicans. I mean, in terms of, you know, I remember one of the pundits saying that there are two kinds of elections. There are governing elections and there are protest elections. This election is not really about governing. It's all about protest. And there are people on the left, too, more Democrats, who are very frustrated. And, you know, apparently, you know, some of those folks like Trump as well. So, you know, it's unclear exactly where all of his support is coming from, but certainly there are a heck of a lot of people who are unhappy with the way things are. And it's, you know, I really don't see the path of which element becomes the strongest, because Trump seems to bring together a kind of a weird group of people that are all supporting him that don't fit well into their own political party. So I don't know. We're just going to have to see how this all blows up and what happens when the dust settles.
Do you see anything similar on the Democratic side with, you know, kind of a mainstream versus a further left party-based split? Or is this something we see often in Democratic politics, not necessarily a realignment there?
Well, I think the Democratic side is a little different. I think there is absolutely, as you say, this frustration, though, with the status quo on the left as well as the right. So to that extent, Trump and Bernie Sanders are tapping into kind of the same emotion. I think one of the differences, and I think that this came out even in South Carolina, Hillary Clinton has been talking about Barack Obama a lot and his policies and about supporting them. And that has actually gone really well for her. Obama's approval rating amongst Democrats is in the neighborhood of like 80%. So I think that, yes, people do want to change from the status quo. The fact that they are still pretty loyal to this president suggests to me that this isn't quite the transformational change or, you know, the realignment that's happening possibly in the Republican Party.
We'll leave it there for now, Karen. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
That's Karen Hoffman. She's visiting professor of political science at Marquette University. She joins us to talk about presidential politics and Super Tuesday.
Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll talk to a state capitol reporter about the 46 bills Governor Scott Walker signed into law yesterday. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Thanks to everyone who pledged over the course of our winter membership drive. Means a lot. Thank you so much. News is next on Central Time on the Ideas Network.